My name is Joe, and this is the House of Pod. If you've never listened before, we are a medical sort of podcast where we try to discuss medicine and health in a relatable way, and we'll answer questions you may not feel comfortable asking your doctor and definitely won't bring up to your friends. On today's show, we'll talk with Ben Padilla, a pediatric surgeon at UCSF. We're going to talk to him about the challenges and rewards of operating on kids, along with communication with their parents. Stay tuned. The opinions expressed on this podcast are broadcasted for educational and informational purposes only and do not represent the opinions of our employers. These opinions are not intended as a diagnosis, treatment, or as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a local physician or other healthcare professional for your specific healthcare and/or medical needs or concerns.
To the House of Pod. I'm Kaveh.
And I'm Joe.
And Lizzie can't join us today. She's attending a LARPing conference in Minnesota.
LARPing?
Live action role playing. So Joe, how are you?
Terrific.
Yeah?
Yeah, pretty good. Pretty good. The springtime's coming. Fishing season for boring crap that I'm not going to talk about right now.
Striped bass. All that striped bass.
Oh, yeah.
Something funny happened to me today.
Really? Go ahead.
Yeah. So, I'm sitting in the patio area, outdoor patio area of a Whole Foods. I don't know why I'm buzz marketing Whole Foods. It's not like they need our business. Whole Foods, if you're looking for a podcast to sponsor, look us up. And eating my lunch, and I see this guy walking down the parking lot. He's not really paying attention to what he's doing. He's kind of like looking off in the distance, and he doesn't see that he's about to be hit by this really big van that's backing out of a parking space. Now, what transpires next is all like, this all happened in like maybe 1 or 2 seconds, but it felt like a lot longer because I was like going through all these things in my mind. Like at first, I'm like, is this guy going to see this van? And I'm like, no, he's not going to see this van. Is this van going to see this guy? No, it's not. It's going back right into him. And I'm like, my mouth is totally full with like food. Is there anyone else that's sitting here going to notice this? And I'm like, nope, it's just me. And so like, you know how like you want to be a hero in those situations. You want to like say something cool or do something cool. This is the best I could sort of muster as I had like green beans sticking out of my mouth.
Was it just enough to save?
It was just enough to get his attention.
Great.
And like the attention of everyone around me who thought I was having like some sort of stroke. And the guy was like, oh, thanks. And then like I felt like a little hero, but not a very cool one.
Well, did you feel like more of a hero today than you do during, you know, your daily routine where you're helping people?
Oh, yeah, I see what you're saying. Good question. Is this sort of helping or heroic activity like better, the same, or worse as like my typical thing?
Right, that's what I'm trying to ask you.
That's a good question because we talk about this a ton, like how you sort of like savor those wins when you have a win in medicine. But, you know, you do it so often, you do it so routinely that it's hard to appreciate it. Hmm. We should always stop and be like, you know, today I helped somebody, you know, hopefully more than one person. We should always be able to say that. But you do it enough, you do anything routinely enough, you probably don't appreciate it that much, right? So I'm sure some guy who saves people from being hit in parking lots all the time probably doesn't feel that big about it, you know? Huh. But, should we do an email?
Let's do it.
Okay. Let me get an email here. Okay. Dear House of Pod, my gastroenterologist is having me come back for a colonoscopy 3 years after my last one. Am I getting ripped off? Well, this is... Okay. So it's really hard. Okay. So what they're saying here is that... they feel like they're being brought back too soon for a repeat colonoscopy.
Yeah, we've talked about this before, I think.
Have we? I'm sure we have. It's a tough one. It's hard for us to say without more information. It's a problem. Is there are sort of guidelines and there are sort of algorithms that we use to help us determine when you should come back. There is some flexibility in those guidelines, and there is a little bit of give in that, and these things change over time, so it's hard to say. So I can't really tell you if you're being ripped off for sure or not.
But you can tell us if it's common to get one every year, every 10 years, what's the norm for someone who's healthy with crazy assumptions?
A lot of factors go into this. One, your age.
Age, right.
Two, your family history. Is there a family history of colon cancer? And if so, which family members and how old were they? Then your own personal history with colonoscopy and polyps. How many? There are certain polyps that you can have that are of higher risk and would predetermine you to coming in sooner rather than other polyps, which are less concerning. And there are some polyps that are completely benign. You don't need to worry about it at all. And then there's some polyps that are benign but precancerous.
Getting deep, man.
Let's go down this rabbit hole. So it's certainly possible. If there was something, particularly if there's something concerning about this polyp, so if it was like a benign but precancerous polyp that had some concerning components, say, for example, it was a tubulovillous adenoma, that's just a type of precancerous polyp that's a little bit more concerning, or if it was of a certain size.
If that one of those were the case, what would you do? Would you have the person come every... Just trying to get an idea.
Say in this case, let's give this gastroenterologist the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
I mean, we should. We technically take this Hippocratic oath and everything that we're supposed to not.
Thought it was a hypocritical or?
No, it's a different one. Yeah. We do no harm is like our whole thing. So let's say that this person went in and had a colonoscopy. And also, I don't know this person's age. We'll assume they're of normal screening age. And they had a colonoscopy that showed a, say, 15 millimeter polyp or 1.5 centimeter polyp, then I would say that's a big polyp. Having them come back in 3 years is a reasonable thing to do, take a look. So, it's a lot goes, I'll need more information on this. I wouldn't assume your doctor is ripping you off, but it's okay to ask your doctor those questions. Be like, why? Yeah, I think so. People ask me all the time. They'll be like, hey, why am I coming back in for a colonoscopy? I just had one like 5 years ago. I heard 10 years is what you're supposed to do. And then we'll explain. There were certain things
education.
That were found.
Yeah, that's true.
It's totally reasonable.
It's good for both sides.
No, it's totally a reasonable thing to do, I think. Don't you think?
Yeah.
Don't you want to know?
I just thought you were going to say, doc, are you trying to rip me off?
Well, you don't have to say like that. You don't say like that.
Yeah,
because you have to, assume your doctor is not trying to rip you off.
Yeah.
I shouldn't say this because we're probably going to
never say never, but most doctors aren't trying to do that.
I mean, most doctors are not trying to do that. Right. So, so that's a good question. If you have any more questions, please do not hesitate to contact us at hopquestions@gmail.com or 408-444-6623. Please rate us on iTunes, by the way. If you haven't done that, do that. It really helps get more listeners to the show. So September 8th, if you're in the Bay Area, if you're in the San Francisco Bay Area, September 8th at the Hotel Utah, the Resurrection Men, a band with myself, with Joe, and some assorted other members of the House of Pod family that you may recognize, like Way, who was on the show way back when, and Nadim, one of our producers. Come and visit us. Come hang out with us. Tell us you're there from the show. Joe will buy you a beer. Coming up next, we have Benjamin Padilla, UCSF pediatric surgeon. We're going to talk to him about the highs and lows of being a pediatric surgeon and talk to him about some of the special sort of issues and circumstances that you face when you're a pediatric surgeon. Stick around. Welcome back to the House of Pod. We have a special guest today. We have Benjamin Padilla, pediatric surgeon at UCSF. Benjamin, thank you so much for coming on.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
Can I call you Ben?
Absolutely.
Benji? How awful is Benji?
It harkens back to my childhood, which wasn't bad.
No, yeah, you had a good childhood. You were born in Guatemala, right?
That's right.
Cool. When did you come over?
I was 5 years old when I came to the United States.
Do you remember anything about Guatemala?
Yeah, I remember a lot.
Did you come from a family of doctors?
No.
What did your parents do? If you don't mind me asking, what did your parents do?
So actually, my mother grew up not so far from this neighborhood. So my mother's a San Francisco native.
Oh, right on.
And my father was from Guatemala.
Uh-huh. My
father was a helicopter pilot.
Oh.
And unfortunately, died when I was pretty young.
Oh, sorry.
And so with that, that's why we moved back to the United States. But I did grow up around medicine. My mom's a nurse. And mm-hmm. so, you know, I got exposure to hospitals and, you know, caring for people and stuff as a kid. So.
And now you're a pediatric surgeon.
That's right.
And it's a field that I don't think even doctors know a lot about. So tell us just a little bit before we go into pediatric surgery. Tell us a little bit about how you got interested in doing it.
Well, you know, I feel really lucky because when I was a medical student, I sort of thought I was going to become a cardiologist or, you know, something along those lines.
But you're like, what sounds better to girls in a bar, being a cardiologist or a pediatric surgeon?
I never really got much mileage out of either one of those or saying that I was a doctor. But
really?
No, man.
Oh. It's because you're good looking. You don't need it. No. He looks like Mark Ruffalo for the listeners, in case you don't know. You can look at his picture on our Facebook page.
You know, when I went on the surgery rotation, I just sort of felt like that was kind of my tribe. You know, I related to the surgeons. I liked the work that they did. I liked the intensity of it. And then I also just like working with my hands.
So let me ask you this. Like, you know, the general, if I'm going to do vast generalizations, we think of pediatricians as being like the nicest of the doctors, the most accessible of the whole doctors, on that whole doctor tree of all the different kinds of doctors you can be. There's like family practice and pediatricians tend to be like the most down to earth, like the nicest and the most accessible. Whereas with surgeons, particularly specialty surgeons, we tend to think of them as being a little bit higher on those branches, further out there, a little bit less accessible. The job kind of requires them to be pretty focused, to be pretty driven. They're less about the people interactions. So where does a pediatric surgeon fit in that?
You know, I at least for me personally, and I think in terms of my colleagues, the other guys that do pediatric surgery, when I was training as a surgeon and I got exposed to the pediatric surgeons, I was like, you know, if surgery is my clan, the pediatric surgeons are my family.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really sort of identified in some ways with the diseases and the things that they treat, but a lot of it was just sort of the way they related to patients, the way they related to one another.
Yeah.
It wasn't that I came into it saying, oh, there's this one disease that I want to take care of and that's my life's calling. It was more just sort of like I felt like that's where I belonged.
Right, right.
Where do we fit into the spectrum of things? I think probably a little bit more towards the surgeon spectrum, but mm-hmm. among surgeons, I think we probably communicate a little bit better than mm-hmm. the average surgeon. If you want to get under a pediatric surgeon's skin, though,
mm-hmm.
you call him a pediatrician.
Ah. Yeah, totally. I can see that.
I wear my training as a badge of honor.
Right,
you know?
Sure, sure. No, I get that.
It's tough, though, for a patient with that because you're kind of a hybrid, right? Pediatrics, or what's a pediatrician?
No, he's a surgeon. It's just that his population is the pediatric population.
Right. So that's not a pediatrician is minus the surgery. Just
they treat medical problems.
Right.
So they treat things with medicines, sure. basically, where you know we operate them.
So you were kind of finding your focus. It sounds like relatively early, like you kind of felt like pediatric surgery was sort of your calling, and from pediatric surgery, do people specialize within that a lot? Is there a lot of specialty within pediatric surgery?
To some degree, you know, I think that one of the things that appealed to me about pediatric surgery is just the breadth of problems that we take care of. We operate all over the body. We do all sorts of different things. But that's a double-edged sword. So on the one hand, you know, some might say we're the jack of all trades, but perhaps the master of none.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't do 300 lung operations
mm-hmm.
a year.
Mm-hmm.
I might do 20.
Right, right.
I don't do 300 thyroid operations a year. I might do 30.
Mm-hmm.
And so the challenge is sort of kind of being able to bring your A game to all of those things.
Right, right, right. Right. And hopefully there's not so many sick children that need surgery so often that you're seeing hundreds and hundreds of some of these tough cases. Some of these are pretty rare.
Well, that's
even for someone at UCSF, it's a center for these things.
Let me ask you something. As you're talking about what sort of drew you to this, to the surgery and working with children and so forth. From a patient, I'm thinking to myself, surgery is already very high stress, high pressure type job. I would imagine throwing a child into the whole mix. Does that change your approach? Does that make you feel more pressure at all? Or is it something that you sort of aspire to and that drives you?
I definitely feel more pressure, you know, operating on somebody's child. For one, you know, just kids, you know, we see them in everyday life. They're pretty vulnerable. And the parent's natural instinct is to want to protect them. So the challenge is not just getting the patient to trust you and give them permission to operate on them and take care of them.
Right.
The challenge is trying to build a relationship with the kid, but also building a relationship with their parents. So I think the most taxing or demanding part of my job isn't the cutting and sewing. It's actually that making a connection with the families and with the patients.
Right. You mentioned that part of what makes you guys maybe a little different than most surgeons is that you have to do more communication. I'm assuming that's the biggest challenge of it is sort of dealing with the parents. You know, being a parent myself, I know how we can be when it comes to our children being sick. It's a very rare and unique moment you'll see in us. You'll see, I'm sure, people showing amazing amounts of love, but it's also very stressful, and it's probably hard for them to not take that out on you at times.
No, they most certainly do. However, I think that that same degree of pressure and stress that comes with taking care of sick kids is met with an equal measure of reward. You know, having a kid give you a hug, seeing a kid bounce back, having parents say, you know, I appreciate it.
That's a good point. I mean, the highs and lows of your job, they seem to me like they would be more extreme than that of, say, a typical surgeon or even, say, an adult medicine doctor like myself. Because the high is you save a kid's life. I mean, that's what more of a hero can you be? That's it, right? But then at the same time, every surgeon loses patients at some point, right? There's always some difficult things. There's always losses that we have to take. How do you deal with that? How do you deal with those?
Well, I've thought a lot about this, and I think it's actually one of the central parts of trying to be able to be able to do this for a long time. And so I would say that the highs are incredibly short-lived.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like you get to take another victory lap and, you know, people throwing roses at your feet.
You got to move on to the next thing.
You move on to the next thing, and there's not a lot. The only thing that can, while the successes can give you some confidence, they can also generate hubris, where you think that you're in control of the situation or have some ability beyond what you actually have. And the lows, they stick with you for a really long time, you know, so the highs are short lived and the lows can be with you for a long time. And the challenge is to try and shake those lows.
Yeah.
Cause if not, you really can't keep doing your job effectively.
Right.
My boss, the guy that trained me, he always used to refer, he is sort of a maven of medical history. So he always used to refer to this famous speech called Equanimitas. And in this, he talks about not letting your successes generate too much confidence and hubris in you, but not letting those lows get to you too much either. Mm-hmm. You really need to be able to maintain some steady mind frame in order to be able to do your job effectively.
Yeah.
And I certainly don't claim to have mastered that by any stretch, but I find myself coming back to that time and again.
Yeah, we talk about that a lot, the balance we have to walk. We can't be robots. We don't want to be robots. We want to connect with our patients. But at the same time, if we take every bad outcome with sick patients, and there's always going to be bad outcomes sometimes, you know, if we can't somehow shake them a little bit, then it's hard to do our job long term. And I've certainly seen doctors burn out. You know, it's hard to be an oncologist, for example, if you don't care about your patients, because you're probably not that great at it. But at the same time, if you care too much, you're going to see a lot of losses in that field. I mean, how can you go on? It'll burn you out. It's a real fine balance that we have to walk sometimes. And I certainly don't have the answer to it either. I mean, it sounds like you do a pretty good job of sort of sucking the marrow out of those wins, but you can't stick with it too long. And then at the same time, trying to learn from a loss, but not sticking with that for too long either.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I also find that the wins are different. You know, the win for me before was a part in some way proving to myself that I could do something. I was able to do that difficult operation that maybe not a lot of other people could do, or that I wasn't sure I could do. And now a win for me is like, man, I made it so that kid doesn't have to wear diapers to second grade anymore.
Yeah.
And he can poop in the toilet, and he's like he's psyched that he can go to summer camp. Like that is a great win for me.
Yeah.
So I think in some ways, like the wins have changed a little bit, mm-hmm. where it's not so much about maybe in some ways what I've been able to accomplish. And I feel a little bit badly admitting that, that for me, some of the wins were that in the beginning for me, but now it's a lot more about just having a good outcome for the kid, however that might come.
Right. Well, I don't think that's anything to be ashamed of. I mean, like a big part of being, I mean, no one is under the false assumption that doctors don't have some bit of ego. We have to some degree, right? Or we wouldn't be where we are. We wouldn't be driven. There's a little bit of that. But it sounds like over time, the things that give you joy, the things that give you energy, the things that give you inspiration have probably changed. Like, what do you find? We talk about this a lot. Like, how do you find inspiration in the job? You have to some degree to keep it fresh and keep it going. Like, where do you find the inspiration in this?
Well, I mean, to be certain, I still find inspiration in just the challenge of a difficult problem being intellectually stimulated. I certainly find inspiration in that. I find inspiration in working with people that I respect. But most importantly, I think I find inspiration from the patients that I treat. You know, the resiliency that you see in kids, and not just their ability to bounce back physically, mm-hmm. but, you know, you see kids and families go through some really horrible things.
Yeah.
And sometimes they don't end that well.
Mm-hmm.
But even through some of those difficult things, you see the beauty in people and how they love one another and support one another.
Yeah.
That's certainly inspiring for
right.
me.
Right. Yeah. Right. Let me ask you, are you a father? If you don't mind me asking.
Yeah, I got two kids. Yep.
Two kids. And did you have them after you finished your training or in the, like,
I had them when I was a resident. So I was just about finishing my residency when my second child was born. And then during my fellowship, my kids were pretty young and tender. So I got to say, when I was a fellow and seeing some of these sick babies around my children's age.
Oh, man.
That was kind of tough.
Right. I was going to say, how has it changed or has it affected your...
You know... my kids are probably going to listen to this, but, you know, what's their...
Hey, kids.
You know, once... they go from being like sort of baby / toddlers to kids, you know, like when their breath stinks in the morning and their feet get sweaty and stinky.
Yeah, yeah.
They're not quite as vulnerable as you know, when they were tiny. So
right.
So and it's not to say that they're not sort of vulnerable and tender now, but you know, those first 4 or 5 years,
yeah,
the kids really depend on you and their lives are really intimately intertwined with yours. Once they get to be to school age, they, you know, like it or not, they kind of have their own lives. They have tough days at school and all that stuff. So during those couple of years of my fellowship, my kids were in that sort of young, really tender period, yeah. and it was hard to see children their age going through tough stuff.
Right. Do you think it made you better, or do you think it made it worse for you?
Oh, it made me better. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, it made me better. It made me a better doctor.
I could see that. I mean, being a patient or being a family member of patients has made me a much better doctor. We talked a little bit off air about this. We talked about how a simple, and we talked about this on previous shows as well. We talked about how what can seem like a relatively simple thing to us. A kid comes in with a disease that you know very well. You know the outcomes of it are generally very good. You know the procedure or surgery you're going to do is pretty straightforward. And you're probably going to do a couple of them that day. But for that person, that patient, that family member, that procedure, that test, that whatever that is the most important thing happening to them in their lives at that moment. And maybe it's the most important thing happening to them for that week, that month, that year, you know? So it's a very, it's always good for us to get that perspective. I think being a parent is a huge part of that.
Yeah, your point is really well taken. You know, trying to strike the balance between this is pretty routine, I can do this safely, trust me. And saying, you know, I know this is your kid, and I know that you love him dearly, and your child means the world to you. I'm going to take care of him like he was my own. And that you take this seriously. It's a challenge to be able to communicate that in a 10-minute conversation immediately before they go back into the operating room when you're getting consent. I think I've gotten better at that with time. Mm-hmm. But it's a challenge, yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm sure.
What about challenges on the clinical side? Is there a different way of working with a younger patient from the standpoint of things like anesthesia, different types of methods you may use with adults that you can't use with children or vice versa? Is it a different type of training that you would go through as well? Or
yeah, you know, there's a whole... You know, I think one of the things about being in a children's hospital is that there's people are really in tune to the special needs of kids. And you might say, okay, the anesthesiologist gives the same medications to put them to sleep and the same medications to wake them up. I don't know. That's not what I do for a living. But the way they approach it and the way they talk to the kid, whether they let the parents come back with the child as they're putting them to sleep, the way we have special staff to try and educate the kids and explain things to them in a way that they understand, it is really different. You know, we have these people called child life specialists who are really specialized and skilled at trying to convey to children really sort of some complicated and scary things to try and make it a little bit less scary for them. But yeah, there's definitely, there's a lot of similarities, but, many of the differences actually, in my view, tend to be sort of stylistic, how you approach a kid and get a kid to trust you. Whereas an adult, you might say, all right, I'm going to put an IV in you. This thing's going to hurt, but suck it up. Sure. You know, how do you do that with a kid and still have them sort of trust you the next time you come into the room?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. As well as the anatomy, though, like on a physical side, is there a difference, would you say, in doing X surgery on a child versus the same procedure on an adult? I guess are the skills...
I think one of the reasons that as a pediatric surgeon, you're able to do so many different things. So for example, I'll do colon operations. I'll do lung operations. I might do thyroid operations. One of the reasons that I'm able to do that is because the kids are actually really pretty forgiving. They tend to be... They're not obese, and they haven't beat up their bodies like a lot of adults have.
Right.
And in many ways, their body's actually really pristine. Like the anatomy, yeah, in a kid, you know, you open up a kid's belly and looking inside, it's beautiful. It's like it's perfect. It's
wow.
The way it's supposed to be.
Whereas mine is sort of like,
yeah,
it's gonna, there's like little loose screws floating around, some duct tape here and there. It's just like a cobweb, and maybe like one of those dust balls comes rolling, yeah, through.
That's really interesting. I thought you were going to say the opposite, where it would be more difficult to typically operate on a youngster.
Well, I mean, but there are some problems with,
sure,
scale. But sure. But the truth is that the two extremes are the most difficult ones. So, you know, operating on a tiny little baby that maybe just weighs 3 or 4 pounds and operating on somebody that weighs, you know, 400 or 500 pounds, those two extremes are pretty tough. But, you know, sometimes it just strikes me, you know, I've operated on morbidly obese teenagers that you know, weigh 300 pounds. And then the next operation I do is a tiny little premature baby that weighs 4 pounds. And so, you know, we do deal with a really broad spectrum. And I think, and as far as the technical parts of it, I think that's the biggest challenge, is just the breadth of diseases that we treat, as well as just, you know, some of the breadth of some of the technical things that we have to do.
Do you feel like the scope of the problems you're running across are changing over time? Like, for example, are you running across more problems related to morbid obesity in children, if that's on the rise?
You know, that it certainly is. One of my partners, that's what she's interested in treating. She's started a program here. There's several other big children's hospitals in the country that have programs for surgical treatments of morbid obesity. You know, I can't say specifically that there's been a sort of huge shift in the pattern of diseases that we're treating, aside from those related to obesity.
Right. If your kids were to tell you that they want, how old are they, roughly?
My son's 8 and my daughter's 10.
If they start telling you they want to be a doctor when they get older, what are you going to say? Are you going to encourage it? Are you going to say, well, let's be open-minded about it, there's other options? Or are you going to discourage it? Because we hear a lot of people talk about how medicine's changing. It wasn't what they envisioned when they started the field. Is it something that you would encourage in your kids?
Hopefully I can sort of maintain a fairly neutral position. You know, when I talk to people that I trained with who are children of physicians, or friends of mine who are children of physicians, and after I saw what my dad went through, or my mom went through, I never want to be a doctor. I never really understood that. But I see it in my kids some. They're like, no, man, I'm not. Like, I mean, they're really young. And
they
like,
see you going in the middle of the night, and they're like, what are you doing?
Man. It's like, what are you doing? But on the other hand...
you'd be like, dermatology's nice.
Yeah.
Apologies to our derm friends. Sorry about that, guys.
On the other hand, you know, I think my kids are, I think they're proud of me. And so much as, like, you know, I think they wrap their brain around that, you know, if I got to go in the middle of the night or on the weekend, it's, the way it's couched. And I think that this is really what the motivation is that I got to go help somebody.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like I got to go to work so I can make some more money.
Right.
It's I got to go to work because I got to go help somebody.
Yeah.
And so I think that they see the value in that, and hopefully that's what they'll take away from it.
Mm-hmm.
So whether that leads them down some other career path, that's fine. But there's lots of ways that you can help people.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be in a hospital, that's for sure.
Yeah. I'm sure they're proud of you. I'm positive. What you had a question, do you? Another question about some of his research.
Yeah, I read a little bit about you in the past year, and there was something called analgesia. I don't know how to pronounce that. I guess that you're...
I was really looking forward to you saying that word, and I was kind of hoping it was going to be worse than that. So you actually did okay. I'm kind of disappointed, actually.
I had to throw anal in there because of the GI people. Right. But it was specific to the noose procedure. Is that correct?
Yeah. So it's called the NUS procedure.
NUS procedure. Okay.
So
jeez, Joe, don't embarrass me.
No, man.
The NUS procedure. Everyone knows what the NUS procedure is.
Meanie.
I have no idea what the NUS procedure is. Please explain it to us.
Well, there's some kids. Usually, they're sort of teenagers, right around the time they're going through this growth spurt. You probably remember some kids from high school who either had this pigeon chest where it comes out, that's called the pectus carinatum. I treat that too, and usually we just treat it with a brace like you treat braces on your teeth. We try and flatten out their chest, and that actually is pretty effective. And then this guy, Dr. Nuss, developed this operation for fixing the sunken chest, the opposite problem.
Excavatum.
Excavatum. That's right.
Excavatum.
That's right. And so the idea of this operation, it's sort of like braces. But imagine if you had your braces put on and your teeth straightened out all in one day.
Mm-hmm. Right. Brutal.
Pretty brutal. It hurt. And it does hurt. Okay. And so one of the big problems with that operation is that it's really painful. And, you know, kids are in the hospital for about a week trying to control their pain. a buddy of mine had this idea. There's this device where you can freeze nerves, and it's a very controlled way of damaging the nerve. Mm-hmm. And it makes it so the nerve stops working, and the nerve will regrow, and eventually sensation will come back to normal.
Wow.
So a buddy of mine had this idea of doing that for the kids with the NUS procedure, and he's like, dude, this thing, it actually works really well.
Is this guy a doctor, or is this just...
Somebody's
my barber, he had this idea. I'm like, let's just try it. Sounds good.
So you know, I don't take credit for the idea of applying this to the treatment in the NUS procedure, but the first time I tried it... I talked to the kid and I said, you know, this device is FDA approved for a similar thing, but for patients that have these big, horrible chest operations. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, I've read a lot of, in the literature about it, that it's safe. This thing is FDA approved. It's not like I'm doing some experiment on you. I said, but I've never used it for this operation. And some people have some experience with it, and I want to see if you're up for it. And he said, all right, let's do it. And so usually after you do this operation, like the next day you got to go and literally like grab the kid by a shirt collar and get him up and out of bed because it hurts, but you got to get him up and moving. So after I did the operation, I went by to see this kid later on that day. And I was like, where's Johnny? And he's like, oh, he's walking in the hallway. And I was like, no, you're kidding me. And I mean, the kid had no pain. And when he touched his chest, he's like, I can't feel any of that.
Oh, wow.
So what I do take credit for, and me and this woman that was, actually this man and this woman, they're residents that have been working with me doing some research, we wrote a grant. We got some money from the NIH, one of the big government agencies, and they gave us a little bit of money to study this in a more formal way. Mm-hmm. And we just actually finished wrapping up the trial. And what we showed is that kids that have this cryoanalgesia, they have way less pain. You know, a lot of the kids we actually send home now, we don't send them home on any narcotics.
Oh, wow.
Any of that oxycodone, OxyContin, any of that stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas before, the kids were on it for anywhere between 2 weeks and a month. So we sort of avoid or sort of skirt the risk of them sort of becoming dependent on these opioids.
Yeah.
And they suffer less. They have less pain. They're able to get up and about. And so I'm pretty proud of it. You know, it's not... Yeah. I'm not going to win the Nobel Prize for that.
No, Trump's going to win the Nobel Prize. Well, don't worry. It's already taken care of. It's in the bag.
But I would say that, you know, it's changed the way people do this operation. And so I...
That's huge, man.
Innovative.
I lay some claim to that. But like I said, sometimes it's not even necessarily the idea. A little bit of it is being able to execute the idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think we did a good job on that one.
You know, a big part of, you know, being a doctor, what you really want more than anything is to leave some lasting impact. And you certainly do that within each patient you touch. But then doing something like this that changes the way people practice medicine, that's huge. That's about as much as a doctor can ask for. I mean, you're either interested in that sort of thing or you're interested in being like Dr. Oz on TV. And this is like much more like meaningful. So I think that's great, man. I think that's really cool.
You know, I aspire to sort of being able to do something that might actually help and have some impact, but it sort of felt like I was just kind of banging my head against the wall. It's like, when am I going to get a good idea? And sometimes it's just sort of dumb luck and being at the right place at the right time and having the right people around you. So
yeah, you're a modest guy. There's a lot of people that probably helped you, but I think that you're probably downplaying it. And you came up with something pretty important. It relatively early in your career. I mean, you're not an old guy, so you still have lots of career ahead of you.
Thanks, dude.
I mean, you're older than me. let's make that clear. Let's be clear. I'm younger than you, but still. Okay, so Ben, on behalf of all the patients and all the families that you've helped over the years, I want to thank you for your sort of caring and thoughtful approach and for your skill, obviously. I can't express how important your job is to these people. All these families, their kid their family member, that child, is the most important person in their life. And you taking care of them is the most important thing to those families. So on behalf of all those people, thank you so much for coming. Thank you for being on. Thank you for all you do. And we hope to get you back on some day. Does that sound good?
Thanks, man. I really appreciate you guys taking an interest in what I do. It means a lot to me.
And for everyone out there listening, remember to check us out on Facebook, like us, follow us on iTunes. Please rate us. It really helps get more listeners to the show if you do that. We're also on Stitcher as well. Take care.
All anecdotes and patient-related details were changed with respect to date, sex, and certain details so that patient identification is not possible.